government began playing out at the southern border when the Department of Justice announced a zero tolerance policy that resulted in complete chaos as they began prosecuting with criminal charges any individual who was presenting at the border, regardless of whether or not they were attempting to ask for asylum. The result of this crisis, of course, was the separation of thousands of children from their parents, but it created a secondary crisis as litigation was filed and requirements were imposed on the U.S. government to stop their inhumane practices. We believe that as a result of all of this, the U.S. government has begun to clear detention space at the southern border, and in doing so has essentially moved the southern border to Albany, New York. In mid-June, we first found out that the Albany County Jail, which has been used over years to house immigrants mainly in transition to the detention facility in Batavia or who were arrested by ICE locally, that facility would begin being used to house immigrants on a much more sustained way. And we believed at the time that this meant about 30 to 40 individuals being transferred to the Albany County Jail on a weekly basis for about 6 weeks. And indeed, that is what happened the first week after this announcement. The second week after this announcement, a plane full of 100 migrants newly arrived from the border arrived at the Albany County Jail. 2 days later, a second plane with another 100 migrants arrived at this Albany County Jail. And on July 5th, one day after Independence Day, a third plane of 100 migrants arrived from to be detained in the Albany County Jail. All of these individuals were arrested or apprehended at the border. Most of them, the overwhelming majority, are asylum seekers fleeing persecution in their home country. About an estimated half so far are from Central America and a few from South America. The rest are from Asia, South Asia, East Asia, Eastern Europe, Africa. We even have one individual from Syria. Several of them have been separated from family members that they were traveling with, including about 10 who were separated from minor children. It does not appear at this time that the parents that we have in the Albany County Jail are subject to the injunction and therefore not part of the current reunification efforts that are happening around the country as advocates press the government to meet its obligations under recent injunctions. These individuals are arriving at the Albany County Jail incredibly disoriented. For the most part, we've been having to draw maps on legal pads of the United States to explain to them where they are. They have no paperwork. Some of them report having been told to sign paperwork, but then were not given copies. Others, potentially the paperwork was put with their personal belongings, which they have no access to. They were moved from the border to New York in the clothes that they arrived in the United States with after spending several weeks at the border. We believe that many of them have been criminally prosecuted for criminal entry, or at least there were attempts made to prosecute them, but because they have no paperwork and because they are confused and disoriented, we are actually unable to ascertain the breadth of that issue and how many of the detainees at the Albany County Jail have actually undergone criminal prosecution. Many of them actually presented at a port of entry to ask for asylum and then found themselves detained, some of them separated from the family members that they were traveling with, including siblings, spouses, grandparents, aunts, uncles, and other family relationships. Some of them have had medical issues that have had to be treated, and we are told that there is a good chance that we should continue to see these transfers from the southern border to the Albany County Jail. Now, the Albany County Jail, from what we understand, does not have a contract with ICE. This is what is called an intergovernmental agreement, where other federal agencies have a contract with the county jail to hold federal detainees when necessary, and that ICE is piggybacking onto these contracts. There are 20 to 30 county jails in New York that have these types of agreement, including the jail across the river in Rensselaer County, and we found out recently that there appears to be some detainees at the Rensselaer County Jail, but we have had no access to them. As a result of the situation, and as my colleague Meredith Borden is about to explain, we've implemented a rapid response emergency legal services effort at the Albany County Jail, much like what happened at JFK Airport, much as what is happening in other parts of the country, we are not the only place to be receiving these border transfers. About 120 were transferred to a detention facility in Sheridan, Oregon. We know of another roughly 200 who were transferred to a detention facility in Lumpkin, Georgia. To our knowledge, we are the ones with the highest number, and there also have been a few cases here and there of individuals transferred to the federal detention facility in Batavia, New York, which is an ICE-run facility about an hour east-southeast Buffalo, but they are much more at capacity than the Albany County Jail was at the time that these transfers began, and therefore are not able to absorb the high numbers. So that has been more of a steady flow than a giant transfer the way we've seen in Albany County. And I'm going to conclude passing this over to Meredith Forden, but I want to say, as one of the persons who spent a lot of time at JFK Airport, that lawyers have once again responded to what is essentially a disaster relief situation. And we are spending our nights and we are spending our weekends on a volunteer basis to respond to this emergency created by the U.S. government, once again, with no plan, with no explanation of how they were going to roll this out. This is the chaos that we are seeing now is very similar to what we saw during the first travel ban at the airports. And I'm happy to answer questions after Meredith and Sarah have had a chance to speak.
Thank you. We're now going to hear from Meredith Forden.
Thank you, Camille, and thanks to everyone for being on the call today. So picking up where Camille left off, this is absolutely an emergency situation and an incredibly chaotic one that volunteer lawyers and community members have worked very hard to try to bring some sort of order to, in order to seek justice for the people in this situation. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about what that looks like and what kinds of coordination have made it possible to launch this response, to maintain it, and to have the information that we do today about the people who are being held in the jail. So once we got wind that these transfers were likely, although as Camille said early on, we did not understand the incredible volume and the speed with which this was going to happen, we began planning a legal response. As soon as that volume and speed became evident, we ramped it up to a massive scale and are working in real time, essentially to build the plane as we're flying it, to maintain a legal response that can be present and effective for the long term, or for as long a term as the administration requires through their use of these policies. What this response looks like today is a coordination between numerous partner organizations and volunteer attorneys, as well as volunteer interpreters across New York State. Right now, we are at the jail every single day, meeting with individuals who have been detained, conducting intakes, learning the situation of their migration, of their apprehension, learning what issues, including legal issues, mental health issues they need assistance with, and doing emergency triage, essentially. In addition, as Camille said, these are asylum seekers. That means that they are in a legal process right now. They're going to have what's called a credible fear interview. If they don't pass that interview, they will not be able to stay here and present their claims to a judge. So on top of this emergency triage intake, we are also working very hard to prepare people for those interviews, help them understand what is this system that they're in, what are their rights, what should they expect, and work through with them what options may exist for their legal case. In order to make this a reality and to make it work, we are relying on literally hundreds of volunteers, the vast majority attorneys, but also community volunteers and, of course, interpreters who have come to the jail. Every day we're there with attorneys conducting intake, conducting prep sessions. We have supervisors who are experienced immigration attorneys across the state who have answered the call, who are supervising the volunteers themselves on a volunteer basis. We have volunteer coordinators who are themselves volunteers. We are collecting data. We are tracking trends. We're making sure that the people who are in this jail not only have access to the services that they need, but also that we have clear information on what the administration is doing so that we can prepare for the long haul and also so that we can respond immediately as necessary, where necessary. So now I want to pass this off to Sarah Rogerson at Albany Law School, who can talk in a bit more detail about the local response, which has been incredibly valuable to this effort.
Thank you, Meredith, and thank you. Sure. Can you hear me now? Hello?
I can hear you.
Can you hear me? You can hear, okay, yes. Sorry. Thank you, Meredith, and thank you, everyone, for joining the call. I want to bring the local perspective to contextualize everything that Meredith and Camille have already shared. In large part, due to a longstanding arrangement with the local sheriff, Craig Apple, that has been the largest driver of our ability to so quickly mobilize over 200 volunteer attorneys and interpreters locally at the beginning and now from all over the state to respond immediately. We were able to have attorneys on the ground as early as 24 hours within the first group of individuals arriving at the facility. As I said, in large part to a longstanding agreement, which was really rooted in providing parents who were picked up locally by the Department of Homeland Security and transported temporarily to the Albany County Jail to be screened under a prior directive from the Department of Homeland Security called the Parental Interest Directive, which was really meant to prevent the separation of parents from their children permanently as a result of the family justice system and the immigration prosecution mechanism not communicating with one another. So that was really the genesis of this relationship, which really allowed us to get in very quickly. Contrast this collaborative, coordinated, rapid response to the story that Camille mentioned coming out of Rensselaer County right next door, which is the only county in the entire state to seriously pursue a formal agreement with ICE to deputize local law enforcement as immigration police, commonly referred to as a 287G agreement. Albany Law School has been working closely with a local legal service provider organization, the Legal Project, and the sheriff and his staff to make sure that detainees have immediate access to legal services, and we are mobilizing and empowering other groups on the ground locally to provide religious services, additional mental health support beyond what the jail is currently equipped to provide, as well as a fund to direct resources to individual detainees' commissary funds, which the sheriff and his staff are assisting us in making sure that that can happen. The sheriff has been very responsive to every request we have made, including providing phone lines that are secure and free of charge, lock boxes to secure attorney materials confidentially, which are on the way and will be controlled by us and not the jail, and rapid response to any emergency medical need for detainees, given their condition upon arrival from the federal facilities that they were transported from. As such, this is a very unique story in terms of that type of collaboration between local law enforcement, and is sort of a story of local law enforcement resisting in a way that makes sense to law enforcement agents in cooperation with a legal team that is well organized and powered by the engine of NYIC and the Emergency Response Collaborative. Thanks.
Thank you, Sarah. We're going to now begin our Q&A. One moment. If you would like to join the queue, please press *6, and we will begin. So we'll give folks a second to join. Okay, great. We're going to start the Q&A, and again, if you would like to join the queue, please just press *6. Okay, we are going to begin. From the Associated Press, you are unmuted.
Hello? Hi, it's Mike Hillett. Hello, it's Mike Hillett, the AP. How long do you perceive this group of asylum seekers to be at Albany Jail, and what's the next stop for them physically in the process?
So this is Meredith. I can talk first about the legal process that they're in. So right now, the vast majority of these individuals are still awaiting what's called their credible fear interview, or their CFI. If that interview is quote-unquote passed, that gives the person the right to pursue an asylum claim before an immigration judge. So their true asylum case and immigration case would begin at that point. They would also have the ability to seek bond and release from detention, although that is not in any way a guarantee that they would be released, particularly depending on which judge they end up in front of. From there, the case would proceed as a standard asylum case in immigration court, either from a detention center or outside of it, hopefully that individual is granted relief. Where they go physically from here is less clear to us. To be frank, as Sarah just said, we have been able to build a strong program and partnership with the Albany County Jail, and so it's very valuable that we've been able to have access to these individuals, provide support, and get information. If someone does move forward in the legal process, and if they were not to be released from detention, they could well be transferred to another ICE facility within the state, potentially even outside of the state. And if they were transferred outside of the state, I would note that they would lose some of the protections that New York State has provided to immigrants who are in detention through the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project. I also want to say that New York State has provided $50,000 towards this emergency response effort, which includes members of the Liberty Defense Project, so we're very grateful for that. Camille, I don't know if you want to jump in terms of other transfer issues.
Sure, and well, I have some broader issues, and I don't want to prolong this answer too much, but there are some complications. So the first one is that, as Meredith pointed out, these individuals still need to go through their CFIs, and as some of you have covered, there was some new guidance that came out last week around gang claims and domestic violence claims that will probably affect, if I had to guess, about a third of the individuals that we've met with. So we're following that very closely. There's some very serious concerns around that guidance and the legality of that guidance that some of our national partners are looking into. So we're going to be tracking that very closely because before they can pass this, they won't be released until they can at least pass a CFI. So the question of, you know, how many are going to be able to pass a CFI when we've already started seeing blanket denials of so many claims in other parts of the country, especially at the border, is a matter of great concern to us. But for those who do pass CFIs, if they presented at a port of entry, so if they actually went up to a customs port and said, you know, they wanted to ask for asylum, they should be eligible for parole. And there was recent litigation by the ACLU on that matter that requires them to grant parole, which means to essentially allow these individuals to leave detention freely without having to pay a bond. Now, we've all seen how good the U.S. government has become at obeying injunctions, so obviously we'll be tracking that very closely. The last part of it is that if they don't qualify for parole, they'll be able to request a bond in front of an immigration judge, and that will be in front of the courts in Batavia, New York. And we've had significant concerns about the bond practices of that particular court, with no bonds being set or bonds being set in very, very high amounts, usually double digits. Of course, by law, an immigration bond has to be a minimum of $1,500, which is a lot for somebody who arrived potentially without even so much as shoes on their feet. But we definitely have certain individuals, those who were actually transferred in that very first small batch of individuals who came from the Batavia facility after they had deportation orders and were working on appeals of their cases, and some of the individuals have bonds as low as $4,000, which is unheard of these days in immigration, and they're still in detention because they haven't been able to pay it. And if they're not able to pay a bond, or if they're not given parole, they will be held in detention, possibly in Albany County Jail, possibly in another facility if ICE chooses to transfer them, in order to, and they'll be held for the duration of their case, which of course is very, very difficult because it's hard to win a case without a lawyer to start with. It's almost impossible to get a lawyer from detention, and we're doing the best we can, but at this point we have no capacity to take on full representation of these cases.
All right, thank you. We're going to move on to the next question. Hi, you're unmuted.
Hi, this is Anara Virji with Al Jazeera English. I'm not sure if I misunderstood this, but I thought Camille said that it does not appear that the parents who are in the jail who have been separated from their children are subject to the current injunction, which would allow for reunification by July 26th, and I was just wondering if I misunderstood that or if I could get some clarification on that.
Sure, the parent. No, you didn't misunderstand. That was what I said. The parents that we have that were separated from their children, the children are either U.S. citizens or they have been reunited with a family member. Sometimes it's the other parent or a spouse. Most often it's a sibling or an aunt or an uncle or that type of familial relationship, and as a result, they're no longer considered to be in OR custody. And so our understanding, based on speaking with many people, is that the because they're either U.S. citizens and or because they've been reunited with family members, they are not subject to the injunction. There are a few families that we haven't been able to locate where they're, you know, sometimes, for example, a father, mother, and children arrived and the father was separated, which was always practice. Even under the previous administration, when families traveled together, the mother was detained with the children and the father was separated from them. And so there are a few that we haven't been able to locate, so we don't know if they're in a family detention facility somewhere, if the mother's being detained separately from the children as well, or if they've been released. But we are exploring options to reunite all of these families. It's just that we can't do it under the current injunction.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move on to the next question from the Times Union.
Hi, this is Masara from the Times Union. I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit more about the conditions that the detainees are living in right now at the jail. I've heard that they're being really treated very well by the sheriff in the jail, but that also some of them have been separated from their family members within the jail, and they haven't had access to resources outside of the jail and whatnot. So if you could just go over that a little bit more for me, that would be great.
Sure, Ms. Sarah, I can. This is Camille again. I've been doing this job for 15 years. I have visited I don't know how many number of jails and other detention facilities, and I have never experienced the level of cooperation and the concern for the well-being of immigrant detainees that I have witnessed at the Albany County Jail. But I would like to ask Sarah, who's the more local person and has been working in that jail for many, many years. She can probably give you some more pointed insights, but I just wanted to say that.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, I can just add on to that. We've been intaking individuals, that meaning hearing their stories, identifying their legal avenues for relief, and that we've been problem solving around any additional issues. As early as week one, we identified an issue where two of the detainees who didn't know each other before had formed a close relationship because they both spoke the same language and they were a minority group among that population. Due to some movement of population within the jail, they were separated, and one of them raised that with our team. I sent communications to the sheriff's staff about that issue, and they reunited the two detainees back together so that they had each other's company that evening. So that's the level of responsiveness that we're seeing. If there are two relatives that are not able to be housed together, it's because in the county jail they have to house men and women separately. But to the extent that any visits would need to be arranged, we would be able to communicate with the jail staff to arrange those visits. So we're asking volunteers who are working with us to flag any of those types of issues on the intake forms which are uploaded every evening or within 24 hours of the intake, so that anything that we see, we can address directly with the sheriff's staff. We have approximately five core or key staff that we have direct access to for a number of issues, from technology to gate clearance to detainee issues to food compliance with respect to individuals who have faith restrictions about the types of food that they eat. We've been able to problem solve around that as well. So as Camille said, I would just echo that they've been incredibly responsive, and so far they haven't declined the request that we've made.
Great.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move on to the next question.
Hi, this is Jennifer from WNYT, the NBC station in Albany. I have two questions, piggybacking on the TU's question about do these folks need or have access to things like clothing, medical care? You did speak a little bit about the food. And then my second question was, are you finding that these immigrants are also victims of human trafficking? Were they approached to be smuggled across the border in a way to, like, maybe promised that they would not be detained, and then now they find that they are?
This is Camille again. If you're asking if we have individuals who may have been victim of human trafficking, that's always a concern with border arrivals, but we haven't established that conclusively with any of the detainees that we've screened so far. If you're asking about the smuggling and how that's being handled by the U.S. authorities, like I said, they haven't been given paperwork. We have no idea what happened at the border, though some do report that they spoke to judges and had some sort of criminal sentence. We're aware of at least one case where ICE approached the client to ask about the conditions of how they were brought to the United States and the assistance that they paid for it. But at this point, I can't say more about that.
Okay, and what about the need for, like, clothing and medical care? Is that being taken care of?
Yes, it's being taken care of. I don't know if Sarah has anything she wants to add there, but every individual who's had a medical issue that we've been made aware of has been flagged for the jail. In many instances, they had already been seen, and if it was, you know, if they hadn't been, then it was arranged for right away. In terms of clothing, they're in a jail and therefore wearing the jumpsuit, you know, that is required of them. But they're given sweaters and they're kept in temperate conditions, I guess.
Right, okay. And do you have enough interpreters? I know there was a move to get a lot of people to volunteer, and then a lot of people did come forward. Are you finding you have enough now, or do you need more?
Hi, this is Meredith. Yeah, we have absolutely been overwhelmed by the generosity and the interest and support of volunteer interpreters. Of course, there are specific languages that we need and specific times where we need people to come in, and so that's been a big part of the coordination effort, is making sure that we are matching up individuals in the jail with attorneys with appropriate translators at the times when everyone is available. So that's an ongoing effort. We've been partnering with local volunteers in the area who have been truly, truly incredible, some of whom are there every single day listening to these stories, which are quite difficult to hear in some cases, as well as volunteer interpreters from firms through our partnership with the Association for Pro Bono Counsel, and of course, attorneys who have language skills themselves from legal services organizations across the state and from firms as well have been donating their time. Sarah, I'm not sure if there's anything you want to add about local translators, but feel free to jump in.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add is that we aren't putting out a mass call for volunteer interpreters and translators because, due to the outpouring of support, what we are able to do is we've identified a core group of individuals who have a lot of experience and who have been, as Meredith said, working very closely with us in the jail, especially Spanish speakers. We have a core group of volunteers. And so to the extent that we need to reach out on an individual basis for languages such as Tigrinya, which is a less common language, we're doing that on an individual basis based on the volunteer database that we've now gathered together, as well as professional interpretation and translation services that have reached out to indicate that they would be willing to donate hours of their time so that we can, in an emergency situation, make it work.
Thanks, Sarah. This is Meredith. One last thing that I will jump in on here in terms of need, right now, probably for coordination and client services, our biggest need is a language line that we would have access to, just to be able to maintain really regular support of the individuals at the jail.
Okay, great. Thank you. We're going to move on to the next question.
Hi, go ahead. Hi, how are you? It's a reporter from World Journal. I heard from several people who just moved from this jail from Exeter. They told us the jail's condition was very crowded and terrible. So do you have any information about that?
I'm sorry, I had a hard time hearing you. You said that you've heard from several people that the jail conditions are terrible. Is that what you said? And you're asking for comment on that? So we were able to take a tour of the facilities, and they appeared to us to comply with ICE detention standards. I think, and when we've spoken to detainees, the overwhelming majority have told us that they feel that they are being treated well, and that their needs are being responded to. I will, however, say that at the end of the day, it is a county jail, and that it is individuals who are being detained by the U.S. government who have not committed a crime and who are being treated like criminals, and that is inherently wrong. And if I was them, I'm not surprised. If I was them, I would be equally in shock. I would be equally furious to be going through this treatment, because at the end of the day, you know, it's a county jail, and there's only so much that we can do to improve the conditions. Like we said, the jail has been incredibly cooperative and willing to respond to our concerns and listen to our concerns when it's been about the conditions and things that are, you know, specifically within their control. Obviously, a lot of this is in ICE's control, but for the things that are in their control, they've been incredible partners. And for those of you who've ever met me, you know I've never said that about any detention facility ever. So I don't take the fact that I'm making these comments lightly. But yes, I mean, it's a county jail. We're doing the best we can. They're doing the best they can for individuals who everyone agrees should not be in this position and should certainly not be in this location in the first place.
The people who he is Chinese, so I just, because he said there was no Chinese translator, so I just wonder, do you have offer any Chinese interpreters in your organization or
yes, we do. And again, I'll just highlight that this is an entirely volunteer effort, and so we have reaching out to all of our partners, and we have volunteer Chinese translators. As I said, the coordination of translation services is a big lift given all the moving pieces. We've put out a call for translators for the languages that we need, and thanks to the fact that the jail has set up secure phone lines for us, we can also begin to do some telephone interpretation, which is something that we plan to integrate into this project as it moves forward.
And this is Camille again. I also want to mention we have had Chinese interpreters, primarily Mandarin, on site to help us with initial screenings. Many of the Chinese detainees, not all, but many, have been able to secure private representation, so won't need to go forward with our services. And you know, presumably those attorneys either speak Chinese, Mandarin, Cantonese, whichever language the detainees need, or have interpreters who can help them with that. But when we've had to, we've been able to secure interpreters, and we've had a pretty great response from groups here in New York who speak East Asian and South Asian languages willing to help out.
So you mean in your organization you have some lawyers that they speak Chinese and Cantonese to help them, right?
We don't provide legal services, so we don't have lawyers. We're just coordinating the lawyers.
Oh, got you. Okay, thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. We're going to move on to the next question.
Hi, Sarah. It's Liz Robbins and Camille and Meredith. This is more for Sarah on a daily basis, just trying to figure out what is the schedule like? When are you allowed in the jail? How many hours a day do you meet with the detainees? Is it done in a separate room? Walk us through what happens on a daily basis.
Sure. So the jail has opened up its visitation rooms. If you walk in, the visitation rooms are immediately on the opposite side of basically the general waiting room. There are some security protocols that we have to walk through as volunteers. Mm-hmm. But once we check in and enter the attorney visitation space, it's the same visitation space that's used for general visitation. So what we've done is we've cross-referenced the general visitation with the attorney visitation hours and eliminated the visitation spots where the general population is visiting, because it's just it would be very loud
okay.
in there because there are a lot of people visiting their loved ones at that time. There are mm-hmm. private attorney rooms. There are 4 to 7 private rooms, depending on our needs. And then there is what's called an overflow room. And the overflow room is basically another open space, which is where we've been able to give large group presentations, for example, credible fear interview presentations and legal information to groups of 20, as long as they're all same gender. So on any given day, we may have a large group presentation happening in the overflow room, one-on-one credible fear interview preparations happening. Typically, we try to have those in the private attorney rooms, given the sensitive nature of a lot of the mm-hmm. material that's being discussed. And then there's a large visitation room where we have typically 2 to 3 attorneys working on general intake in the different corners of the room. The jail staff keeps to its own in a separate corner, and then whenever we need to bring additional detainees in to speak with them, the jail staff has a list, and then they keep the detainees sort of coming and going on a regular basis so we don't lose any time on transfer. We've ironed out a lot of kinks on that end of things.
Wow.
So it's a pretty smooth operation at this point.
We're How many hours a day?
Yeah, so the jail, the sheriff has approved us to be there all weekend long. So Sunday, Monday, Friday, Saturday, we have 4 shifts of 1.5 to 2.5 hours. Sometimes they'll let us stay later, or they'll allow us to stay in between a shift change if they have the staff to accommodate that. For example, we requested that next Monday and Tuesday, we have a volunteer group that wants to be in there basically the entire day.
Wow.
So Monday, that would be 8 a.m. till 9:30 p.m. And so the sheriff has agreed to bring in additional staff so that we don't have to take breaks in between shifts. That's a long day for a lot of attorneys, and we're encouraging our attorney volunteers to make sure that they're paying attention to vicarious trauma and engaging in self-care and rotating who's doing the interviewing so that we're being trauma sensitive with our volunteers as well. But basically, from the jail's perspective, they want us in there as much as humanly possible.
Wow. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you. We're going to move on to the next question. Go ahead, from WNYC.
Hi, it's Beth Fertig, and I'm curious because I missed the very beginning, so I'm sorry, but we've reported on other counties, notably in New Jersey, that have contracts with ICE and people there who are very concerned and they don't like that, and I'm wondering if you think that it's good for some counties to have the contracts with ICE because they can provide lawyers like yourselves, at least in New York. And you were contrasting Albany to Rensselaer, I believe. So what's your position on this, you know, on counties that sign agreements to house detainees in their local jails? What do you think of that?
Hi, Beth. This is Camille Mackler from the New York Immigration Coalition. I think, first and foremost, we are not okay with the detention of immigrants generally and certainly not asylum seekers specifically, which is the bulk of this group. I think it's been a while since I've looked at it, but I believe that the New Jersey jails have contracted directly with ICE, and they tend to detain individuals who are mainly apprehended on the interior of the United States. Not that that makes much of a difference. Like we said, we are not detention of immigrants in county jails, in private prisons, anywhere. That is not how a human system is supposed to work, and it is certainly not how a civil system is supposed to work, as contrasted to a criminal one. I think right now we're just trying to make the best of a really bad situation, and we are very, very appreciative to the Albany County Jail, which, again, from what we understand, does not have an ICE contract with ICE at all, but we are appreciative of all the efforts that they've made in helping us access these detainees. In fact, we're there at their invitation. We have
you know, been able to provide a measure of dignity, and we've been able to provide much needed information, which at this point is a lifeline to these individuals. So we're grateful for that, but we would never agree with the concept of contracting with either county public prisons or with private prisons for the detention of immigrants.
So if it's not a contract with ICE, what is it that enables Albany to house the detainees?
So maybe you missed it because I addressed it at the beginning.
Sorry.
But there are some jails, and we think there's about 20 to 30 in New York. I'd have to confirm the number, have what's called an intergovernmental agreement. So other federal agencies, for example, the U.S. Marshals, have contracts with local jails to hold detainees, to hold inmates on their behalf. Generally, it's a transit type of situation when somebody was arrested locally and they need a place to hold them until they can transfer them to a more permanent location. Other times not, but these are often referred to as IGAs, and ICE has the ability to basically piggyback on these agreements and so use the bed space that other federal agencies have contracted for with these local jails to house ICE detainees. And our understanding is that is what is happening in the Albany County Jail right now.
Are there any places in New York that have agreed to an ICE contract like the ones in New Jersey?
I believe that most of the jails in New York are IGAs, but the Rensselaer County Sheriff became the first sheriff in many years, I think last year, Sarah can confirm, to enter into a 287G agreement with ICE, which is essentially ICE training his officers and deputizing them as ICE immigration enforcement agents. So that's different than a bed space contract, but it does mean that the sheriff's employees, the officers in the Rensselaer County Jail, are empowered by ICE to conduct immigration enforcement. This was done with very little transparency and with very great concern from advocates statewide and locally. To my knowledge, the closest that New York facilities have in terms of an actual agreement with ICE, the National Immigration Justice Center, which is part of the Heartland Alliance based out of Chicago, they have a matrix available on their website. You should come up with a pretty quick Google search that details every single contract that ICE has or is able to use in every single jurisdiction in the United States. So you're able to look up the matrix and filter by state to only pull up the New York ones. And if you see the initials IGA, then that facility has an intergovernmental agreement. And if you see that it's if not, it'll indicate that it's a straight contract with ICE. From memory, I believe the county jails in New York, which is all we have since it's illegal to operate private prisons in New York, from memory, all county jails have IGAs in place, not direct contracts with ICE. And I should also mention that the money that ICE pays for this bed space, or that the U.S. government pays for this bed space, does not go to the jail. It goes to the county.
This is Sarah Rogerson. I just want to confirm that we first heard of the 287G agreement that Rensselaer County was pursuing last fall and immediately tried to start getting information about that. It took us months to get any measure of transparency and actually a story by Liz Robbins, who's on the line, which ultimately led to them disclosing more information. But other than that, and since then, they have not been transparent with us at all about what's going on. So it's really in stark contrast. I would say that from my perspective, because we have been working in the jail for such a long time, I just want to remind everyone that this started when we were working with small numbers of locally detained.
This started when they were working with small numbers of locally detained.
Yeah, and that it was that the nearest immigration courts are in Buffalo and New York City. So that's 4 hours away or 2.5 hours south from here.
The immigration courts were in Buffalo or New York City.
So in terms of the local, the way that we've been operating locally, our thought was we would prefer to be in there with this type of a relationship and be able to get information to families in sort of a rapid response on a much smaller scale. Obviously, we are not equipped nor desirous of this being a long-term situation at the Albany County Jail, and we think that any county that supports this type of arrangement should be reinvesting some of the money that they are gaining in order to reinvest in legal services.
They are talking about
so that's something for the folks in New Jersey to think about, where I understand that Essex County executive has really been focused on alleviating the burden to the taxpayer.
With all caps, ICE, period. That's not what is going on with Albany. Period. I will give you the full transcript. And
okay, great. Thank you. We're going to move on to the next question.
Here is what.
Hi, it's Nassara with the Times Union again. I just had one more question. At the beginning of the conversation, Camille, you were talking about the transfers from the border to jails across the country. I was just wondering if you could go over those numbers again and kind of give us the big picture idea of how many detainees Albany County Jail has been getting, you know, on a nationwide scale compared to other county jails.
Sure. The Albany County Jail so far has received 300 transfers from the border, and then maybe 30 to 40 more from Batavia, who are in a vastly different legal situation. There were 120, I believe, or 121 that were transferred to the Sheridan, Oregon facility, which is a federal facility, I think, and another 200 transferred to the Atlanta, to a detention facility, we call it Stewart. It's in Lumpkin, Georgia.
Okay.
So those are the only two other transfers. It's possible that there have been transfers to other states. I mean, for example, when we speak to some of our some of our clients who have been separated from adult family members, they mention that some of their family members are in Nebraska, are in Florida, and other places. But from other lawyers around the country, we know for a fact that there was sort of this big mass transfer of individuals to Sheridan, Oregon, and Lumpkin, Georgia.
Okay, and the idea is that these transfers are happening because ICE is kind of under pressure right now with this public spotlight, so they're just trying to empty out their detention centers.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that very well. Can you repeat your question?
Yeah, so you were saying at the beginning, I think, so you think the idea is that ICE is just under all this pressure from the public spotlight, so they're trying to empty out their detention centers and move the detainees to other places to get out of this pressure, or?
No, I think our impression, no one's confirmed this for us, but our impression is that they're trying to make space at the border to detain families together. So their solution to the zero-tolerance family separation fiasco that's unfolded over the last couple of months is, instead of jailing families separately, they're going to jail them together. And so they're trying to make room at their detention spaces, at their detention centers along the border, by transferring individuals to other parts of the country. Now, the way it was done, which is unlike anything I've ever seen ICE do, it feels like ICE was preparing for a big event in their house and they had to clean very fast, so they just grabbed a ton of stuff and shoved it in a closet and closed the door and hoped no one would notice, and we're the closet. And unfortunately for them, we noticed. And it's New York, so we weren't going to just sit by and not do anything about it.
Yeah, of course. Okay. All right, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, if there are no more questions, we're going to end the Q&A. Thank you so much for everyone who joined the call. If you have any follow-up questions, you can email press@nyic.org. That's press@nyic.org. Thank you so much.